So good morning. So let's pick up where we left off yesterday. So yesterday I discussed the what I called the naive Parthan model. Which for proton-proton collisions looks like this. We have two protons coming in from either side of the reaction. The protons are going so fast that their constituents have momenta approximately collinear with the proton momentum. So I can describe the momentum of any constituent by writing x1, x2, p2, or here x1, p1, where x1 and x2 are numbers between 1 and 0, which give the fraction of the total proton momentum carried by this particular constituent. And then these objects come together and they make some kind of high momentum transfer reaction. And so then we get a formula for the cross-section, which is that sigma for proton-proton to whatever the final state is equal to the integral dx1, the integral dx2, if this Parthan has flavor f1 and this Parthan has flavor f2, the Parthan distribution functions appropriate to those flavors. Actually, usually we don't know which side f1 is coming from and which side f2 is coming from, so we have to symmetrize this. Let's call this f prime just for clarity. Times the cross section for ff prime going to the final state at s hat equals x1 times x2 times s. So that's the formula that I wrote for you yesterday, which describes the naive Parthan model calculation of a cross section in a proton-proton, or in general, a hadron-hadron collider reaction. Okay, now, there are obviously some things that are wrong about this model. Probably the main thing that you can complain about, of course, there's lots to complain about in the calculation of this internal Parthan cross-section. Yesterday I was taking that only to lowest order. Sometimes I was only using the QED part where there are quarks and there's QCD involved. But probably the main thing you have to complain about is that the very naive treatment of the proton wave function. That basically I'm ignoring all effects of the binding of constituents and all QCD effects associated with the initial state. In particular, that showed up because in this reaction, these two guys were assumed to have zero transverse momentum, and the reaction has transverse momentum balance, so I would always find transverse momentum balance in the final state. And that's obviously unrealistic. Within the proton wave function, I mean, just by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, these guys will have some finite transverse momentum, and then that can be transferred to the final state. So maybe an interesting question to ask is, where do those effects come from, and how do we include them in this model? And basically, there are two sources of the transverse momentum of the partons f and f prime. The first one is from the proton wave function itself, the non-perturbative part of that. But the proton wave function is bounded, and so this is going to give some kind of power correction. Basically, there's a hard momentum transfer in the problem. Let me call it Q. And these effects are going to be pt squared over q squared. So they'll be down by powers of the hard momentum. Essentially, the faster things are going, the less effect, the more the kinematics is dominated just by the collinear part of the momentum and not by some small momentum. Maybe I should have put here something like lambda or the mass of the proton, maybe is a good thing to put here. But there's another effect, which is going to be logarithmic in Q over the mass of the proton, multiplied by a factor of alpha s. And this comes from QCD perturbation theory. And that's something that once you know about it, you'll see, we'll calculate it, we'll see that it's an order one effect that really has to be taken into account. So where does that effect come from? It comes from an important aspect of massless relativistic, almost massless relativistic kinematics. And that is that if I have a momentum vector, let's write this one, which is massless, then I can split that vector into two vectors. Arbitrarily, z can be a number between 0 and 1, and both of these particles are on the mass shell. So if this particle were massive, this wouldn't work. If there's an angle between them, it doesn't work. But as long as they're approximate, as long as the masslessness and approximate collinearity are both good approximations, then both of these particles can be on the mass shell. Now, let's think about that in terms of the initial state partons. Let's say I have some quark that's going into a hard reaction. And that quark emits a gluon. And then I have the quark continuing on. And then it's going to collide with some anti-quark over here and make a hard reaction. So what I've just told you is the quark is massless in the initial state. The gluon is massless. But what I've told you is that when the gluon is collinear with the quark is, to the extent that this angle theta here is small, the quark is almost on shell. And from its denominator, 1 over q squared, I'm going to get a large enhancement of the Feynman diagram. And so such a thing is called a collinear singularity or a collinear splitting. And it's probably the most important QCD effect on the initial state of parton-parton reactions like this. And so it's something that we really have to, it turns out, understand very well in order to make any quantitative statements about hadron collider physics, in general about parton model predictions. And so this is the first thing we have to repair when we go from the naive parton model to the, let's say, not so naive parton model. So what I'd like to do now is to make a calculation of this process, at least to the leading order, to show you what its effect is. Next week, David Kossauer will be here, and he'll talk about processes like this beyond the leading order. And hopefully, if you get some intuition from this lecture, that'll be useful to you in order to understand what he's going to talk about. Okay, so there are obviously three parts of this. First, we have to do the kinematics more carefully in this process. Secondly, there's some gluon emission matrix elements that we have to compute. And then third, we have to wrap it all up into a cross-section formula. So let me do those things in turn. First of all, the kinematics. I'm going to call this vector P, I'm going to call this vector Q, and I'm going to call this vector K. And let me write P is a massless vector going in the 3 direction. K is the quark after radiation. And I'm going to say that that carries a fraction z of the initial momentum of the initial quark. And it's going to, in general, carry some pt. So there'll be a pt here. And ze, and I'm going to leave some place here. And then q is the momentum of the gluon. The gluon is going to carry the rest of the energy of the initial quark. It has to carry a balancing pt. And it's an emitted particle. It's on shell. And so let's just be a little more careful here. If I write if I write this formula, good. This momentum is on shell to order pt squared. In order pt to the fourth, there are some higher order corrections. But we're going to make an approximation that concentrates on the collinear singularity. So I'm going to just try and keep the first direction here. OK, now, energy momentum is conserved. So here I need a plus pt squared over 2 times 1 minus z times e. And now, we need to see that. We can compute k squared. So k squared is ze squared minus pt squared minus ze squared minus pt squared over 1 minus z. And you can see that this comes out to these terms canceling, these terms adding. There's a z times 1 minus z up here. So this comes out to minus pt squared over 1 minus z. And so this is the off-shellness of this propagator. So what you can see is that as pt goes to 0, this quantity goes to 0. And so indeed, there is a genuine singularity in the Feynman diagram that we're going to have to account. OK, so that's the kinematics. Now what we have to do is to put that kinematics together with a calculation of the matrix element. And so now let's try and look at this process, P, Q, K. The matrix element for that process is pretty easy to compute. It's I, G sub S, we're in QCD, T A, that's the color matrix, U dagger of K. Let me assume that this is a left-handed particle. QCD is parity symmetric, so if I do something for left-handed particles, I can then parity reflect and do it for right-handed particles. If this is left-handed and everything is massless by helicity conservation, that's left-handed. So we're all set. U of P, and then epsilon star sub m of Q, where this is the gluon polarization vector. So now what I'd like to do is to write those objects explicitly for the kinematics that I've given here. Fortunately, in this calculation, in this part of the calculation, I only have to work to order pt. So we'll get some rather simple expressions. So u of p is the square root of 2e. It's a left-handed particle going in the three directions, so that's the spinner. U of k is 2e times z. And the spinner is slightly rotated from this because there's a finite pt. So to first order in pt, this is 1 pt over 2ze. Finally, the photon polarization . There are two possible photon polarizations. It can either be right-handed or left-handed. a right-handed polarization would be something like 1i0. But once again, the gluon is rotated through an angle pt over e in the negative direction. And so I think I got that right. Oh, sorry. 1 minus z. There should be a z here and a 1 minus z here. And then finally, I need the complex conjugate. So this is minus I and this is plus I. OK, now we're all set. The spinner elements that we need are the following. First of all, let's compute it for a right-handed gluon using this polarization vector. That's 2e times the square root of z times pt over 2ze1. The sigma is 1 and minus sigma dotted into this vector. So actually, there's no time component of that vector. It's just from the 1, something like this, from the minus I, it'll be minus 1, 1. And from this term, minus pt over 1 minus z times e, 1 minus 1. And then over here, the other part of the spinner. Okay. Now, what pieces contribute? Well, in order to get up here, we have to use this element. But as you see, that cancels that. So the only thing that's contributing is this term here. And so we're going to get 2e square root of z. The 1 and this factor of pt over 1 minus z times e. It's the same square root of 2 that I dropped yesterday. The e's nicely cancel, and we get a matrix element proportional to pt. If I have a left-handed gluon, come back. It's hopeless. If I have a left-handed gluon, the computation is almost exactly the same. Except that it's a plus sign here. Maybe I have to be a little more careful with signs now. There's a 2e square root of z over the square root of 2. There's the term I got up there, which has a pt over 1 minus z times e. And there's a new term where I take that, there's a factor of 2 here, and it multiplies this. And that gives the same thing that I have up top, the square root of 2 times e times the square root of z times pt over, actually z times 1 minus z this time. And now we're all set. OK. So now we can compute the square of the matrix element. So let's have the sum over the gluon polarization of m squared. That's got a g sub s squared the square of the, oh, you can't even see it up there. Way up there, there's a color matrix that gives a 4/3. There's a 2, the E's have again canceled. There's a Z, there's a PT squared, and there's a 1 minus Z squared and Z squared. And then there's 1 plus 1 minus Z squared. Where, please note, this came from the left-handed gluons, and this term came from the right-handed gluons. Okay. Those of you who are familiar with the Weizsacker-Williams approximation in QED will recognize this term as being part of the usual expression there. And it's no surprise. Gluon radiation has the same kinematics as photon radiation. And you can do more or less the same calculation to discuss initial state radiation in QED. Okay. Well, now we're doing excellently. Now all we have to do is to put this matrix element calculation together with the kinematics and get an expression for the cross-section. And let me do that on this blackboard. So let's just be a little careful here. What we're doing now is computing the cross-section for a proton-proton going to a gluon plus y, where y is the final state. So we have our proton that gives rise to a quark here that emits a gluon, creates a quark, creates a final state y, and on the other side there's a parton from the other proton. And this is a quark. Let me just call that F because we're not worrying about that very much. This is the integral dx1 dx2 fq of x1 ff of x2. Now we have the cross section for this reaction, which emits a gluon. And so that's 1 over 2 s x1, x2 is the prefactor, the integral over phase space, and the matrix element squared. And so let's work on this expression a little. Dx1, dx2, fq of x1, ff of x2. Okay, now I want to take the phase space and divide it into two pieces. First of all, the integral over the gluon emission, and then the integral over the final state y. So there's an integral, please excuse me, d3q over 2 pi cubed times 2q, and then there's an integral over the phase space of y. There is some momentum-conserving delta function. Actually, technically it should be in here, but I'm going to write it out as P plus, let me write P prime as this momentum, minus Q minus the momentum of Y. Then we have the value of this matrix element, which I've written over there. Okay. Then we have this propagator. Now, this is a quark propagator, but what I've done is I've taken the quark propagator here, which is k slash over k squared. And I've written that as the sum of u, u bar over k squared. And I put the u when I computed this end, or the u bar actually I used to compute this end, and the u is going to be incorporated into this matrix element. And so the only thing that's left is the k squared, and k squared we evaluated up there. It's pt squared divided by 1 minus z, and that quantity comes squared when I square the matrix element. And finally, here there's the matrix element for a quark of momentum x1 times z times p to come together with f and make y. Squared. Okay. And whether the initial quark was right-handed or left-handed, this is still the splitting amplitude, and so we're all set. Okay, well, now you can see that some pieces are going to emerge, because now I can pick off this factor, which I can write as k plus p prime minus py, and this factor, and combine them into, oh, and there's one more thing I need, which is I need a factor of z from here. So let's just do a little reduction of this integral. There's a longitudinal part of that integral, which is going to be dz times the magnitude of p, and then there's a d2p perp. 2 pi cubed. The q, the value of q, is dominated by the longitudinal motion, and so that'll be 1 minus z times the magnitude of p, and these terms cancel out. So I've got to borrow a z from here. I guess that goes into the numerator. And then I'm going to borrow this z here and take that into the yellow part. So what I get here is the cross-section for a quark with momentum z times x1 times p to combine with f and turn into y. And all the yellow things that are circled are just go into that. What's left over is my original integral over these Parton distributions. There is the integral over z here. There's the integral over pt from this expression. Let me write that as dpt squared times pi. That's a good way to write that integral. I left out something important. There's a pt squared here, and there's a pt to the fourth here. Let's see, 16 pi cubed. Let me write the rest of this formula. G sub s squared 4/3, 2z pt squared over 1 minus z squared z squared. And now, if all is true and just in the world, things are going to start madly canceling. There is, from this expression, an extra 1 minus z, an extra z in the numerator. And please note from here a 1 minus z squared. Okay, I think I've got everything now. Okay, so now things start madly canceling. That cancels that. It leaves over a 1 minus z. All the z's cancel. And we're now very close to a final expression. So that expression would be the following. Sigma pp going to gluon plus y is equal to the integral dx1 dx2 fq of x1, ff of x2, there remains an integral over z, an integral over pt squared over pt squared. So it's actually a logarithmic integral over pt. And the remaining factors, if I've got them right, are 4/3. We can borrow a 4 pi from there and make alpha s. There's a 2 pi remaining, this is the 2 in the numerator, a 1 plus 1 minus z squared. There was a 1 minus z. This should be a z squared. Please excuse me. This should be a z squared. And this should be, 1 plus z squared over 1 minus z. Okay. And I think everything now, and then times the cross-section for the reaction of a quark now with a diminished momentum making y. Okay. Well, this is now incredibly cool because we started out with a quark with a large momentum. We ended up with a quark with a smaller but still collinear momentum plus a small transverse component of its momentum. The transverse momentum is not large, that is to say, it's only there by virtue of alpha s, but it's logarithmically distributed. And it'll be logarithmically distributed as long as the collinear approximation is good. So if, let's say, q is the momentum transfer in the hard process, this will go up to q, and probably it'll go down to something which is of order m proton. So what we have then is the initial quark coming in turns into the final quark with a small transverse momentum pt, which then goes into the hard reaction. And what's interesting now is that you can view this as a modification of the proton structure function. So instead of having this structure function, I could equally well write this expression as dx2, and then the integral, let's write it dw, over a new structure function, which has the following form. Let's write dx2 ff of x2, leave that aside. And then we can write this as the integral dw of some new structure function that has the following form. It has the integral over z, it has 4/3 alpha s over 2 pi. It has, if we do this integral, some integral which is the log of q squared over mp squared or something like that. It has this kinematic structure, 1 plus z squared over 1 minus z. And then it has this quantity remaining under the integral in the form f of w divided by z. And so what we found is we've slightly modified the original structure function by a factor like this, which is logarithmically enhanced. Now, let's just do a quick estimate. Alpha s at the scale q is something like b0 over log of q over the mass of the proton. Here we have a log of q. The only thing that makes alpha s small is asymptotic freedom. So that's this factor. Please notice that the logs cancel. So this is actually an order one modification of the structure function. And so in addition to this diagram, if we're going to be accurate, we need to compute the same diagram with 2 gluon emissions, 3 gluon emissions, 4 gluon emissions, etc., to have an accurate accounting of what these approximately collinear emissions are doing to the structure function. Okay. Well, so far so good. We've got a very precise result in order alpha s, but now we realize that we have to kind of work a lot harder in order to understand how to put this into a picture of structure functions. However, the solution is really pretty much at hand. Because let's now examine what's going on in this diagram. Here we have a hard reaction at the scale Q. The first gluon emission, the calculation I did is correct as long as the transverse momentum of this guy is less than Q. If the transverse momentum of this gets larger than Q, I have to modify the internal kinematics here and the approximation breaks down. Also, when this is too large, this is going to go well off shell and I'm not going to get an enhancement. The next gluon has a PT2, and for the same reason, this has to be less than PT1. The next gluon has a PT3, which for the same reason has to be much less than PT2. And so to get the order one effect, the gluons have to have some property. That is, in the order that they're radiated, they have to satisfy this inequality. So they have to, we say, be strongly ordered in PT. And this suggests the following beautiful idea, which is that you can write the what happens to the structure function between the non-perturbative part, which is contained in the proton, and what happens to the quark when it actually enters the reaction as an evolution equation. And so let me borrow from what's over there and let me try and write that evolution equation. So the evolution equation I claim would then be the following, that in every logarithmic interval of Q, there's a modification proportional to this quantity to the structure function. And so then we would write a differential equation, d by d log Q of the structure function, let's say the quark structure function. I'm going to return to that notation f of x is equal to the integral here. So it'll be alpha s over pi 4/3. Let me put that somewhere else. The integral dz, the factor p for q to q of z, and f sub f of, please excuse me, x over z, would be, where p from q to q is 4/3 times 1 plus z squared over 1 minus z. Okay. Please notice that dz over 1 minus z, if I integrate all the way up to 1, if I integrate up to 1, that's got another logarithmic singularity. That's the usual soft singularity of gauge theories. Whenever I emit a very soft gluon, there's an enhancement. And that's also going to enhance this effect in a certain region where the gluon is soft and the quark is hard. But please notice that even when the momentum splitting is about equal, it's already enhanced by this logarithm, and it's already an order one effect. Okay, well, this evolution equation was first written for QED and abelian gauge theories by Grieboff and Lopatov. And then it was found in QCD by Parisi, and then in a beautiful paper by Altarelli and Parisi. and also by Dachschitzer. And so this kind of evolution equation is called Altarelli-Parisi evolution, or sometimes it's called Diglop evolution. Okay, now, for QCD, this is not the whole story. Because so far, I've only considered the case where I have an initial quark parton that turns into a final quark parton. But there are lots of other things that can happen in QCD. In particular, I could have an initial quark parton radiate a quark and turn into a gluon parton that then initiates a hard process. Or I could have a gluon parton come in and split into two quarks, a quark and an antiquark. Or I could have a gluon splitting into a gluon. And actually, all of these diagrams have the same dpt squared over pt squared behavior in the amplitude, and so the same logarithmic enhancement that forces us to treat these in order one. And so the complete Altarelli-Parisi or Diglop equations would look like this. There's this term for the quark distributions. There's also a term where a gluon splits to a quark, Fg of x over z. There's the same equation for antiquarks, and there'll be an equation for the gluon distribution. Where the first term would be the sum over quarks and antiquarks of p q going to g of z, f or f bar of x over z, plus p g to g, f g of z, of x over z. And once again, all these functions are relatively easy to compute. Actually, this one we can compute extremely easily because we just change z to 1 minus z in this expression. It's the same matrix element. So if I have a gluon here instead of a quark, this is 4/3 1 plus 1 minus z squared over z. Well, now you see why I got confused about the numerator factor. And also, this is the thing which is the Weizsäcker-Williams factor. PQ from G is, I believe it's a half z squared plus 1 minus z squared. Is that right? Yeah. And PG to G actually, if you'd like a nice exercise, this is the fun one to compute the matrix elements. It's, let's just say, much easier to do it with these helicity spinners or to do it with definite polarization vectors and definite helicity than by the method which is recommended in most textbooks. And it's also a little easier to find it in this form than in the form you usually see it in textbooks. And for those of you who like amplitudes, this form also has an amplitude interpretation that I'm happy to discuss offline. Now, there's only one correction that I need to make, actually, first to this formula and then also to this one. You integrate here all the way up to z equals 1 because the parton here can carry an arbitrarily large fraction of the momentum here. If the gluon is soft, that region is enhanced. There'll be a singularity, which is this 1 minus z, and we have to control that in some way. And that's done with a prescription called the plus distribution. So if you write these formulae actually correctly, there's a plus 3/2 delta of 1 minus z here. And here there is a plus 11/6 minus nf over 9 delta of 1 minus z. And I guess I need to define this plus distribution for you. The plus distribution is defined in such a way that the integral dz of f of z is equal to the integral of f of z minus f of 1 divided by 1 minus z, so it's finite. And basically, what I'm doing is writing the plus distribution as the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of 1 minus z, and then we'll carve out a little region around z equals 1 to avoid the singularity, and then we'll subtract a delta function of 1 minus z like that. The reason for these terms is that, and you'll see that the prescription I wrote here enforces this, that when the quark emits a gluon, a quark at zp appears, but the quark at p has to disappear. And so you have to subtract something as well as adding something so that the normalization of the quark distribution remains finite. And that's what this term here does. Similarly, for gluons, when a gluon splits into two gluons, you have to include the momentum of this gluon in the parton distribution, but you have to subtract that guy. And a convenient way to do that is to say that these gluons share the momentum of this gluon. So the integral dz, z times f of g, has to be, that is, the momentum carried by gluons has to be conserved by this process. And if you're careful about that, then this plus distribution stuff makes sense, and these kernels obey the right property. Okay, that's technicalia. So let's go back to these expressions. Once again, these expressions are quite fun to derive and look at in the helicity basis. Remember, for a left-handed quark, this one came from left-handed gluons, and this one came from right-handed gluons. So if you look at the soft gluons, similarly here, L and R. So if you look at the hardest gluons, they all have the same helicity as the quark, and that gives rise to some polarization effects. In addition, if you calculate this with polarization vectors, you'll see that each term here is a specific polarization orientation of the three gluons which are involved in the process. And if you count, there should be 2 to the third divided by 2 is 4 terms here, but actually there are only 3 terms. And that's a mystery of amplitude physics that maybe David Kossauer will explain to you next week. Okay, that's a lot of formalism. So now what's the effect of this formalism? Well, the formalism actually has some big effects on the parton distribution functions. And there are 3 kinds of effects. So let's go through them in turn. All of those effects are quite intuitive from the general picture that I've described, but the important thing is they're going to be order one effects when we actually put in QCD and do a precise computation. The first effect is that if I have a valence quark in the proton, over a logarithmically large interval in Q, that quark will emit gluons and go to some smaller momentum. Now, yesterday I drew the up quark distribution in the proton as looking something like this. But what we see now is that the prediction of QCD is that that is not actually the distribution that applies to all processes. It's a distribution that applies to processes at relatively low momentum. As the momentum transfer in the hard reaction here increases. And as we have more and more gluon emission before we get to the hard process, the momenta carried by this final quark is going to decrease. And so at one Q, it might look like that. At another Q, it looks like this. At another Q, it looks like that. Gradually, all the valence quarks get removed or pushed down to very low X because of the gluon emission. The second thing that's going to happen is that Fg of X is going to build up, because the way these quarks get from here to here is they're emitting gluons. And so as I increase Q, the gluon distribution is going to become larger and larger. And finally, from this term here, gluon splitting is going to produce quarks and antiquarks. And so that's going to cause the low, and this is, these are at high X. This is at somewhat lower X, let's say X of about 0.1. And so these are going to be below X of 0.1. But as a function of Q, these distributions are going to appear, and also antiquark distributions are going to appear and get larger as Q increases. So in principle, we should see all of these things in the data. And actually, it's interesting now to really look at the data on the quantity that I defined yesterday, F2 of X. Now we see that with logarithmic dependence on Q, the sum over flavors of QF squared times X times FF of X and Q plus FF bar of X and Q. So this is the quantity to which deep and elastic scattering cross-sections are proportional. And now, amazingly, between the original slack experiments, which are down here in red, and the HERA experiments, which are these red points way out at large Q, this structure function is measured over, as you see, a range of five orders of magnitude in Q squared. And in that range, now you can really see the dependence of these various functions on the Alteroy-Parisi evolution. So this is in X from the highest values, X of 0.85, to low values of X of, I think, 5 times 10 to the minus 5 at the top. And what you see is exactly what I said. The valence quark distribution systematically decreasing on a logarithmic scale in Q. And then at small x, the structure function increasing due to gluon splitting to quarks and antiquarks. Here's a very interesting picture. This is a comparison from HERA of the quark distributions at extremely small values of x. So this runs from 1 to 10 to the minus 4, and a comparison of q squared of 3.5 and q squared of 90 GeV squared. So then you can see how much in the low x region this gluon splitting back to quarks enhances the structure functions that are visible in deep and elastic scattering. Okay, well, now I can finally explain to you how you determine structure functions. So what you see is that the process is really very complicated. You have to do experiments. And in fact, people, as I showed you, have done experiments over five orders of magnitude in Q squared. You do some experiments that resolve the difference between U and D and the C. So you add in data from electron deuterium scattering and from neutrino scattering on various targets. You take each experiment and you associate the data from that experiment with a certain value of Q squared. Now you make a model of the structure functions that uses Alteroy-Parisi evolution, that is a solution to these differential equations, typically a numerical solution. Typically, what you would do is you put in a parametrized form of the Fs at low q squared, and then you use this equation to evolve that numerically up to high q squared. And at each q squared, you fit that expression to the data that you're provided. And so in that way, what you generate is a picture of, first of all, the initial parameters. So that would be the Parton distributions, the PDFs at low q squared. And secondly, a picture of the evolution. And of course, the goodness of fit is also a test of QCD and a test of how well these equations are doing at representing the evolution of the distributions. I think the two curves here are actually show the QCD fit, one particular QCD fit, based on the HERA data. And you see that there certainly are parameters where this works extremely well. Okay, so now I can finally show you the Parton distributions of the proton. So there are several groups that do this. This is a group mainly based in Italy called NNPDF. They basically use a neural network model for the initial parametrization of the Parton distributions, and then they apply Altarelli-Parisi evolution. And actually, this shows the comparison at a scale of 10 GeV squared and 10 to the fourth GeV squared. That's 100 GeV in kind of straight out units. And you can see all of the effects that I discussed. So here are the valence distributions. Here's their fit to the C distributions. Please note that the valence up quarks are a little harder than the valence down quarks, as I discussed with you yesterday. Also, the valence, the D bars, are by a non-perturbative effect a little harder than the U bars. A gluon splitting will generate all the other quarks in some, to some extent. So SC, actually down here, there's also B. Here we go. B is invisible at 10 GeV because you're not at a high enough Q squared to have a gluon that can split into two on-shell B quarks. But over here at 100 GeV, the gluon splitting has generated a lot of B and actually a remarkable amount of C in the proton. And this actually is a big contributor to the Drellian process at the LHC, CC bar annihilation, where the two charm quarks have come from gluon splitting, from gluons that came from quarks, which were in the initial wave function. And so these are some pictures that you might keep in mind for what the proton looks like at LHC energies. By the way, please notice that this top one distribution in red is the gluons, and it's been divided by 10 so it can fit on this plot. So to a first approximation, the proton at the LHC is just a big flashlight of gluons shining on another flashlight of gluons coming from the other direction. Okay, well, now that we have these functions, we can maybe be a little more sophisticated about writing the Parton level cross sections. So let me do that in two stages. First of all, I'd just like to rewrite this formula. PP going to y is equal to dx1 dx2 f of x1. Now we know that this is also a function of the q of the reaction, f prime of x2, also a function of the hard momentum transfer of the reaction. And then we have here the reaction x1, x2, s, going to y. And then probably I should symmetrize this because I don't know which side the f came from and which side the f prime came from. Yes?
Quick question. If I compare the your naive plots, let's say on the left-hand side, where all the up fork distribution should look like.
Yes.
They seem to peak at low x. But we don't see that at all, basically, in these plots. Why is that the case?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Up for the valence quarks, we don't see any peaking of the x.
So up v is valence.
Yes.
And what I wrote there is the total up quark distribution.
Okay.
So the total Upquark distribution would go like this, and then it would peak up along this curve. So they didn't write the up and down C quarks, but they're present as well, and roughly equal to the antiquarks. So this will go down, and then it'll go up again.
So there's an implied contribution from the up type as well, but just not shown in these plots?
That's right. That's right. And also for the up and down.
Okay.
I'm sorry, there can only be so many curves on these plots, I suppose. But, you know, eventually at asymptotically high momentum, the valence kind of goes away, except in the highest energy processes. And it all comes from the C in the gluons. Okay. So to a first approximation, this is then a formula that you can use, where you take the properly evolved parton distributions and you fold it with the cross-section. Okay, now, to do state-of-the-art calculations at LHC, you should add to this QCD radiative corrections. So those radiative corrections occur in several places. First of all, this cross-section, which I wrote yesterday to leading order, is known now to next to leading order. And actually, people were working on it to next to leading order for some specific processes, in particular top quark production. This is actually known to next to leading order. Secondly, the Altarelli-Parisi equations themselves are leading order equations. So one should compute the next to leading order contributions to the kernels. And then finally, you need to do a next to leading order contribution calculation of deep and elastic scattering in order to get the equations to fit the data to have the parton distributions be at the same precision as the prediction you're trying to make. So all three pieces are needed, and those pieces actually have to fit together. You guys probably all know that whenever you do a next to leading order calculation in QCD, there are infrared singularities. And all the infrared singularities have to nicely cancel in order for this whole program to work. And that is, it works, but it's a somewhat technical subject. And I think David Kossauer is going to talk a lot about that next week. So you'll hear it then. The other thing we can do with this formula is to write down something very useful for LHC phenomenology, luminosity functions. So let me define them in the following way. Okay, so I've got this formula over here. Maybe if these partons are identical, I should divide by 1 plus delta FF prime. So now we can write this formula as in the following way, as S hat d sigma d S hat is equal to a luminosity function. Tau is S hat over S times S hat times the cross section for F plus F prime going to Y. And so what these things are integrals over the parton distributions with the total center of mass energy, S hat, which is x1 dot x2 constant, and the other degree of freedom, which, remember, is the rapidity of the reaction integrated over. And in the textbook of Ellis, Stirling, and Weber, and actually, better than the textbook, there are some very nice plots on Keith Ellis's website. There are these luminosity functions. And they're very useful to try and understand the various colliders and what you can do at them. So here are just some figures from Keith Ellis's website that I find very useful. So this is various colliders at different energies. This is the Tevatron. This is actually 10 TeV. This is the nominal LHC, and this is, I guess, I don't know, some future collider. The book was written at a time when people weren't yet talking about 100 TeV, but you get the idea. Actually, this is the QQ bar luminosity. I put all four in the notes, but let's just concentrate on the glue-glue luminosity. So if you're going to produce some totally new particle, for example, the gluino in pairs at the LHC, you're probably very interested in the process glue-glue goes to new colored particles, for example, gluinos. And so then you might want to compare, for example, what can you do at 10 TeV or maybe 8 TeV would be somewhere here, the old LHC, and up here, the new LHC. And you see that there are two regimes here which are quite interesting. First of all, when the mass of the thing, so this is S hat, so S hat is basically twice the mass of the thing you're trying to produce. You see that there are two regimes, one where the mass is quite small, so there you're talking about a low cross section. For example, the production of, well, maybe it doesn't apply so much to this, but electroweak production. You're in a regime where these lines become almost straight on a log-log plot. The slope is such that there's a rule of thumb of Gordy Kahn, which is very useful, which is a factor of 2 in energy equals a factor 10 in luminosity. Or to put it another way, a factor of 10 in luminosity is the same, gets you the same as a factor of 2 in energy. And that corresponds to the slope of this distribution up here. Of course, if you try and produce things that are beyond the energy reach of the machine, you run out of steam. And so that reflects the steep drop here. And so if you, for example, compare just the 8 and 14, you see that at 8, maybe it's very hard to produce gluino pairs of mass 2 TeV, which would be 4 here, whereas you have a much better chance, a really significantly better chance, when you increase the luminosity, when you increase the energy by even less than a factor of 2. And so for new colored particles at the LHC, we're working in this regime. For new electroweak particles, though, we're working in this regime. And so you can imagine large steps in the reach of the LHC between the 8 and the 13 TeV machine. Okay, I'd probably better wrap up this lecture, but there's one more thing that I'd like to tell you about this Altarelli-Parisi evolution. And that is that in the same way that collinear emission of quarks and gluons is an order one effect in QCD in the initial state, it's also an order one effect in the final state. And in fact, for exactly the same reason, that if I now have a reaction that produces a final state quark, that quark will emit a gluon. And if the gluon is collinear, then this quark here is almost on its mass shell. And so the reaction is logarithmically enhanced. Similarly, the splitting of gluons into gluons, as long as these gluons are collinear, will leave this propagator almost on mass shell. And again, each of these processes has this dependence, alpha s, the integral dpt squared over pt squared. So it's an order one effect. And so very naturally, without having any reference to the non-perturbative part of QCD, you can see that an initial quark will eventually generate some structure of collinear gluons and quarks, because these gluons can split to quarks, all roughly collinear with the original quark, and a multiplicity kind of as high as you like as you increase the logarithmic interval between the Q here and the hadronic mass scale over here. And this phenomenon actually directly produces the things that in the event pictures I showed you are called jets. If you have, for example, E plus E minus to QQ bar, we can compute the cross-section for this process to leading order in QCD. Actually, there are no gluons in this process to leading order in QCD. But the process is affected by this collinear radiation. The collinear radiation has a very small effect on the total cross-section, but it completely changes the nature of the final state. Instead of a single particle coming out, what we have is a stream of particles. And then eventually, at some stage, hadronization will pair up the various objects that I've made and produce hadrons. And what I'll get is a stream of hadrons with roughly the momentum of the original quark. And so it's actually a prediction of perturbative QCD that the final states of reactions that at their core produce quarks and gluons actually are visualized as jets. So we'll talk a lot in the next lecture about jet analysis. But for the moment, let's just say that that phenomenon is also contained in these Altarelli-Parisi evolution equations that I wrote down. So that's enough for today. By the way, the derivation of this is in the notes. So if you want to go through it, you can go through it carefully. So that's enough for today. Thank you very much. Let me take some questions. Please.
In the Altarelli-Parisi equation, should we also be thinking about like photon emission, like leptons?
So alpha is a factor of 10 smaller than alpha s. So photon emission really is a perturbative correction. It's not order one. Traditionally, people have said, well, QCD calculations are only good to 10 or 20% accuracy anyway, so why do we include QED? But now, two things have changed. The first thing that's changed is that people are now doing QCD calculations that they claim are at the level of 5% or even for Drell-Yan a few percent accuracy. And for that, the electromagnetic correction is essential to actually get the right answer. The second thing that's changed is that we're thinking more and more about higher energies. And so one of the things that can happen at higher energies is that a quark can radiate a W boson. And if I'm at energy so high that I can ignore the mass of the W boson, then this process is collinear enhanced in the same way as the processes that we've been talking about. And this is, frankly, not so small. There's an alpha weak, which is much larger than alpha. Alpha weak over pi times the logarithm of q over mw. And so there are circumstances where this is not a small number. And for example, if you think about Drell-Yan at 3 TeV, this actually turns out to be an order 1 effect. And it's an interesting effect. You think you're producing a muon pair, but the muon radiates a W and turns into a neutrino, and you see hadrons on one side and muons on the other side. So it's considered a priority to include QED and, in general, electroweak corrections into these equations. I think the codes that are public codes now don't include it for the most part, but you're going to see that very soon. I think people are realizing increasingly that it's very important. Other questions? Yes?
Is there a general proof that this sort of factorization into FF times sigma is true to all orders in perturbation theory?
There's a proof for some processes, but it's not true for every process. And so maybe we should distinguish that. The part of this that I've left out and actually haven't tried to explain is the following effect. Let's say I have a quark that comes out of a proton, and that quark initiates a hard reaction. So then there are some other quarks in the proton, or gluons, which are just, in this model, spectators. But in principle, you can have interactions between quarks and their spectators. And so for the case of Drell-Yan, there is actually a proof to wall orders and perturbation theory due to Collins and Soper that processes like this do not affect the total cross-section except by power corrections, 1 over Q squared corrections. Now, there is, however, something, other processes which are more sophisticated. For example, you might want to look at Drell-Yan with specific properties in the final state, or something that people were interested in some time ago. Maybe they'll get interested in it again, the presence of rapidity gaps, where you have for example, you send a gluon across, you cancel the color of this process in a certain region of rapidity. And such cross-sections actually do not factorize. And so it's only for the most integrated quantities that even you expect factorization. And for those, I think the only really clean proof is in Drell-Yan, as far as I know. Nevertheless, I should say, this idea of factorization, that you can ignore the influence of spectators, does work extremely well at the LHC. So when you have appropriate quantities like total cross section. Roughly, let's see. I hesitate to say more because it's going to get into some big technical discussion. At the time, it was thought there was an anomaly in the top quark forward-backward asymmetry. We had a big argument about this at Slack with Stan Brodsky on the side that these reactions were important in generating the forward-backward asymmetry. And a bunch of us kind of did some more detailed calculations, and basically you can't make that picture work to generate the top quark forward-backward asymmetry, even though I think formally that quantity is not protected by a known factorization theory. Roughly, what happens is that at high energy, a proton becomes extremely Lorentz contracted. And so these bunches go through each other and kind of leave the top quark behind because it's a massive particle. And to allow this to communicate with that, as you would have in a process like this. So what Stan was interested in was processes where the top quark would communicate with some other parton. And if you look at the space-time picture, it absolutely doesn't work. But this kind of question goes beyond what's known, I think, to all orders in perturbation theory.
In the beginning, you mentioned the Heisenberg principle. Can you say more about how this relates to the Heisenberg principle?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just saying that if you have a proton of a finite size, then inside you have to have finite transverse momenta. That's just the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But the transverse momenta that you get are only 1 over a Fermi. So they're a couple hundred MeV. So if you're talking about a process that has tens of GeV transverse momentum, this is a totally negligible effect.
So you mean the particle size becomes small, so the transverse?
Yeah. So the proton is of the size of order 1 Fermi, and h bar over 1 Fermi is 200 MeV. So partons have to have a transverse momentum of order 200 MeV. But if you're talking about a process where you generate a momentum transfer of tens of GeV, this is totally negligible. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't say totally negligible. It comes in some very specific places. But it doesn't come in, for example, computing. If you want to compute, for example, d sigma dpt for pp going to a jet, it's totally negligible. It's only when you look at the small PT region that you might have a correction due to these effects.
So if you're having fundamental particles like neutrinos or something like that, you have no size.
That's right.
So is the momentum average would be very large?
Well, what we're seeing that in these calculations, right? The quark has no size. So the momentum that you generate is logarithmically distributed. That's exactly that effect. What I'm saying is that the non-perturbative part only adds some very small amount to the transverse momentum. Okay. Next lecture at 11?
Yeah. A break.
Okay. So let's have a break and get some coffee, and I'm happy to answer any more questions privately if you'd like.